Tonight, as was mentioned, we're going to do the last in this series of 2023 as a year of dramatic developments in fulfilling Bible prophecy. And tonight's subject is the reshaping of Europe required by Bible prophecy. We're going to go back to some fundamentals tonight, brothers and sisters. Now, I finished my last study a couple of weeks ago putting up this particular slide. But the question is the European Union next on Russia's list? I made the point then, we're going to make it again tonight, that it will not be necessary for Russia to invade Germany. Just like this sort of slide suggests, there was a gentleman who was behind Putin, one of his entourage, who made that comment that Germany might be next on the list after Ukraine and Poland and Belarusia. Well, they won't need to be. As you're going to see tonight, it will not be necessary for Russia to take Western Europe by conquest. Western Europe will fall into their hands, and we're going to give the reasons why that will be the case tonight. So let's just step back into some history here. One of the things that's been a feature of our four studies is that we've pointed out along the way that the things that we're observing this year are not new. They've been going on for some time. And way back in 2016, I picked this particular newspaper article up. So let's just have some history first up. This is from the Globe and Mail, which is a Toronto newspaper in Canada. And you can see there the picture of Europe, European Union, and you'll notice there's a thread coming out on the right-hand side. It's all about the unraveling of the European Union. And this was being said in newspapers back in 2016. So there's nothing particularly new about what I'm going to say tonight. It's been happening for a long time, and the culmination is not far away. And Bible prophecy is going to be fulfilled, as we shall see. And then on the left-hand side of that slide, you will see that there's mention made of the financial stress, the internecine strife amongst the European nations, the bankruptcy of some of, particularly of the southern states, the presence of Muslim radicals, the Middle East refugees that swarmed into Europe, and of course what they call closed open borders, because you can cross borders in Europe, but they don't particularly want all of these refugees crossing their borders, so they've got a huge problem, and that problem is weighing them down, as we go to see. So this once vaunted European Union is disintegrating under the weight of insoluble problems, and that's what Bible prophecy requires. It's not 28 nations or whatever it is in the EU that's going to be involved in the events of Armageddon. It's going to be 10, and it won't include Germany or any nation above north of the Rhine or the Danube. They won't be included. So we're going to see what the Bible requires, and that means there has to be a reshaping of Europe. Now, as I said, we're going to go back to some fundamentals. We're going to go right back to the foundations of our understanding as a community of Bible prophecy. And where do you start? Well, you start in the book of Daniel and Daniel chapter 2. And we're all very familiar with Daniel 2 and the image of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you'll notice I didn't say Daniel's image, because it wasn't Daniel's image. Daniel prophesied what the image represented. It was Nebuchadnezzar's image. He was the head of that image. He was the thinking power, the Babylonian thinking power of that image, so to speak. And that's very important, as you'll see tonight. Now, we all know that Nebuchadnezzar's image was designed for two purposes. It was designed to show the unfolding of history of four world empires and then what would follow that right at in the latter days over the time from Nebuchadnezzar's day to our day. That was its first purpose, but that's not its most important purpose. What you can see on the screen there is a quotation from two verses, Daniel 2 verse 28 and verse 35, and they are very important verses. There is a God in heaven, said Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar, that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. And that should be underlined in our Bibles. Nebuchadnezzar's image is primarily about the latter days, not just about the history, that's part of it, but about our times. And verse 35 also makes that point, because it says, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. And you can't break them together unless they are together. So there has to be an image that stands up together. Head, chest and arms, belly and thighs, legs and feet. So it's got to be together, to be destroyed together. And that's what we're going to focus on here in the early part of our study tonight. Now, Brother Thomas made this point that Nebuchadnezzar's image has yet to stand. He wrote this in what we call the Exposition of Daniel, was otherwise known as Anatolia, or Russia Triumphant and Europe Chained. He wrote, "This scene has never been exhibited before the eyes of the world." He's talking about Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the image. "Because the constituents of the Colossus have never yet been put together so as to form the image of the scene." Now, there's one particular phrase you need to notice in this statement. It's this phrase here, "because the constituents of the Colossus have never yet been put together." What that means, of course, is that the territories occupied by those four world empires have to be drawn together. The peoples who now live on those territories of the four world empires have to be brought together under one head so that image can stand up in the land of Israel. And it doesn't stand up, by the way, until it's in the land of Israel and victorious over all comers. That's when it stands. That's the drama of Daniel 2. It only stands for a short while, and then all of a sudden, bang! The stone power strikes the feet and over it goes. It's ground to powder over the next 40 years. That's the great drama of Daniel chapter 2. Now, we're all familiar with this, aren't we? Nebuchadnezzar's image, the head of gold, represents the Babylonian Empire, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar himself. Thou art this head of gold. Then you've got the silver of the arms and the chest, the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Grecian of Alexander and his successors, and then the Roman Empire, the iron of the legs. And then you've got the feet. But this is the thing you need to recognize. There are no feet just yet. The feet of the image have not yet been formed. Anybody here got no feet? Would you like to try and stand up? You got no feet, you can't stand up. So the image does not yet exist because it doesn't have any feet. It will only have feet when there are 10 nations in Europe, southern Europe, in the territory of the old Roman Empire that are brought together. They're described as iron and clay, which don't mix very well and hold together very well. I'll explain that in a minute. Then, when those feet are formed, the image is able to stand up, but it doesn't actually stand up until it's got the land of Israel under its control, because the land of Israel just happened to be an important part of all four world empires. And it's the territories of the empires of old that have to be brought together into one. That's when the image stands up. So let's just review then what we talked about in relation to verse 35. It's a prophecy of the latter days. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image, which we know represents Christ and the saints, became a great mountain. It's the kingdom of God, and it filled the whole earth. So the kingdom of God replaces the kingdom of men. That's what Daniel chapter 2 is all about. Now, what does it mean, really, to you and me here in the latter days? Well, it means this, that there's got to be some developments, and we're watching those developments. Because if the territories of the four world empires have to be brought together, united by God, then a few things have to happen. We have to have this great image power, this confederacy of nations united unto the Babylonian head. And we know that there's a Western leg, which is based in Rome. That's the latter-day redevelopment of the Western Roman Empire centered in Rome. We know that there's an Eastern leg. This is the latter-day redevelopment of the Eastern Roman Empire centered in Constantinople. Now, things are heading in that direction, little by little. And there's going to be some major developments when this great depression, the time of trouble, such as never was, hits the earth, as we've been talking about in our series. Now, we're also familiar, aren't we, that when you come to Daniel chapter 7, which was read for us, you have, of course, an extrapolation, an expansion of what you read in Daniel chapter 2 about the image of Nebuchadnezzar. So we have the lion, the Babylonian power, representing, of course, what we saw in the image in the head of gold. You have the bear, the Medo-Persian power of the chest and arms. You have the leopard of the belly and thighs of the image. And you have the fourth indescribable beast representing the legs of iron, the Roman power. Now, this is why we have to understand Daniel, brothers and sisters and young people. Because if you haven't got a grasp of the prophecy of Daniel, you will never understand the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. And you'll see there, down in the bottom right-hand corner of that slide, we've got an image there of the beast that is described in Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 to 10. It's called the beast of the sea. It's got all four of the beasts of Daniel 7 in it. It's also got 10 horns. And we're going to see, of course, that Daniel chapter 2 has an image with 10 toes, and Daniel chapter 7 has a fourth beast that's got 10 horns on its head. And we're going to see that that represents 10 European nations, southern European nations. And we'll explain that a bit more as we proceed. So when you come to Revelation 13, verse 2, this is what you read. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power. So there's all four of the beasts of Daniel chapter 7. Why would that be the case? Well, of course, this is just simply telling us more details about what would happen in history in relation to the development of the power of Babylon the Great, and ultimately the image of Nebuchadnezzar brought together by Gog. So it's very important to have Daniel as a basis of your understanding of the Apocalypse. There's another very important point that arises out of Daniel 7. It comes in chapter 7, verses 11 and 12. Now, verses 9 and 10 of Daniel 7 are about the judgment on the nations. That judgment will be dispensed by Christ and the saints. The nations, as it were, would be assembled, just like we as individuals will be assembled and judged by Christ. So the nations are going to be judged by Christ and the saints. And this is the outcome. The outcome is here in verses 11 and 12. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, this is the fourth beast, and his body destroyed. So it's talking about the Roman Empire. It is utterly destroyed and given to the burning flame. But what about the other three empires that preceded it? Well, then it says, as concerning the rest of the beasts, that's the lion, the bear, and the leopard, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. And Brother Thomas interprets that as meaning the millennium. So these are the other empires, the peoples who inhabit the territories of those other empires, who will survive the judgments. They will continue on into the kingdom age and then be phased out as time goes on through the kingdom age. But the fourth beast is to be utterly destroyed. So the revived Roman Empire is doomed, but the others survive. So let's focus then on the feet. I want you to come to Daniel chapter 2 with me and have a look at these two verses. Daniel chapter 2, verses 41 and 43. Now, these are very important verses in relation to what we're going to be talking about tonight, the reshaping of Europe. Daniel 2 and verse 41. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, I mentioned that the feet have not yet been formed. Okay, so he sees this on the image. The feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. I mean, you can't really fuse clay and iron, can you? They don't stick together that very well. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. Now, perhaps the most important word in that verse is the one you can see on the screen in green. That word mixed, you just cast your eye down at the bottom of that slide, you will see it's the Chaldean word. Garav, related to the Hebrew. It means to commingle. It comes from the root meaning to braid or to intermix, and by the idea of intermixing, to traffic as if by bartering in the marketplace. Like a lot of Hebrew words, it has this extension. You can sort of go, context determines the meaning of it. It has this extension. It even goes on to be used, this particular word in the Hebrew, it goes on to be used to give or to be security. It has the idea of a guarantor. It's translated, for example, be surety in places like Genesis 44, verse 32, Proverbs 6, verse 1, 11, 15, and 20, verse 16. Now, this word happens to occur four times in these two verses. Let's go to verse 43, the next one you can see. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed, that's our same word, with miry clay, they, and we need to come back and determine who is meant by they shall mingle, there's our word again, differently translated, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed, there it is again, with clay. So who's the they of this verse, do you think? Well, the they is a reference to the iron. It's the iron that shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. The seed of men is represented by the clay. You know, we're all made out of clay, aren't we? It's the common man, so to speak. So it's the iron that takes the initiative to mingle itself with the clay. Now, that's not what happened in history, as I'll point out in a second. That didn't happen in history. It's still future. This has not yet happened. But it is beginning to happen. It's going to happen big time very shortly. So we need to understand what this is telling us. Now, a little point about the meaning of that word. You see where it says to give or to be security, the idea of a guarantor or to be a surety for someone, to back them up. You know that in 1956, when the Six Nations, who formed what was then called the EEC, now the European Union, the EU, when they met in Rome, under the guidance of the Pope, yeah, the Pope, the Roman Catholic Church underwrote the European Union. Right, that's what that word's about. Being a guarantor, an underwriter. It was the Catholic Church that underwrote the European Union. They have big plans for it when they can get control of it. And they will get control of it in due time, as you'll see. So what about history? Well, this is what happened to the Roman Empire. The barbarian invasions in the 4th and 5th centuries, which broke up the Roman Empire in due time and ended it in 476, the barbarians came from the north and they came from the east and they came in and they went all through the empire and divided it up amongst themselves over time. Now, that's the clay. That's the clay mingling itself with the iron, not the other way around. These two verses that we've just read are about the iron taking the initiative to mingle itself with the clay. Hasn't yet happened. Okay, that's very important. Now, there's nothing new in this, brothers and sisters. Let me read to you from Brother Henry Sully's Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy in this little section in the appendix on Daniel, Daniel chapter 2. This is what he says about iron being mingled with clay. In the second chapter of Daniel, the kingdoms of men, I would have preferred him to say kingdom of men, because there's only one kingdom of men, are represented by a composite image consisting of four principal elements. First, gold. Second, silver. Third, brass. And fourth, iron. Each element representing some phase of the kingdoms of men. The fourth element, in its latter day phase, make a little mental note of that, in its latter day phase, assumes the aspect of clay and iron mixed. And then he explains what he means. That is republicanism. Now, if you're a republic, you are, you know, supposedly democratic. Okay? It's the voice, the rule of the people. Okay? That's what a republic is. Republicanism and autocracy. If you're an autocracy, you go to Russia because that's what they've got. They've got Putin as an autocrat. Okay? You go to the Catholic Church and they've got a pope. He's an autocrat. He's God on earth. They're very diverse things, aren't they? Democracy and autocracy. That's what he says. Republicanism and autocracy, shown perhaps in one of its most subtle aspects, in the silent capture of democracy by autocratic ecclesiasticism or religion, enabling the latter to ride into power thereby. He's exactly right. That's what's going to happen. The papacy is going to come back with huge power in Europe on the back of the Great Depression that's coming. And I'll explain to you why that's going to happen in a minute. You're going to come back into huge political clout in Europe. We're going to have a Babylonian head. Yeah, a Babylonian head of the image. So Brother Sully got that right. So let's just have a look then at the 10 toes and the 10 horns. These represent 10 European nations formed by the barbarian invasions of the Roman Empire in the 4th and 5th centuries AD. That's why you find them, 10 toes on the image, 10 horns on the fourth beast of Daniel 7, 10 horns on the beast of the sea in Revelation 13, and 10 horns on the scarlet-covered beast in Revelation 17. It's perfectly consistent, right through prophecy. But just this little aside about these toes and feet and the legs above it. It's very important to recognize that the legs of this image power were not formed until AD 420. So why is that important, do you think? Well, it's important because Britain was not a part of the Roman Empire in 420 AD. The Romans had left Britain in 410 AD, 10 years before the legs were formed. That's a very important fact. So in 420 AD, the Roman Empire was finally resolved into two legs, with an emperor in Rome and another in Constantinople. They were brothers, quite young brothers, actually. And the empire became two. There was two empires. There's one in the east and there's one in the west. The latter-day counterpart is in the process of development, and Gog, of course, will ultimately accomplish that. The feet, with 10 toes, is a confederation of southern European states. Now, I emphasize that phrase, southern European states, united for a time by Gog. It is a brittle fusion of democracy and false religion held together by humanism. You know, so you've got the Iron of Rome, which only exists today in the form of the Roman Catholic Church, but you've got a Pope who, like Revelation 16:13 says, is a mouth speaking forth three unclean spirits like frogs, the spirits of humanism, liberty, equality, and fraternity. I mean, goodness me, he's a Jesuit, and Jesuits are supposed to uphold Catholic tradition. And here he is talking about the acceptance of homosexuals and all sorts of things. Out of his mouth is coming humanism. That's what's going to hold together iron and clay for a short period of time until Christ and the saints smash the feet and the image is toppled. Now, just about the end of Roman rule in Britain. If you have a look at that map and you see there the departure dates at the top on the right-hand side of that slide, 383, there was a final departure. The west and the north of Britain were denuded of Romans. In 401, the final departure from Hadrian's Wall. In 407, there was the final departure of the southeast of Britain. In 409, there was the expulsion of Roman magistrates from the cities. And in 410, there's what's called the rescript of Honorius. He was one of the emperors. And he wrote this rescript and said, we're out. We're getting out of here. Leave the British to themselves. Now, there were some Romans who stayed behind. They wanted to become Britons. But most of the Romans left. By 410, they were gone. But the legs of the image were not formed until 420 AD. So it's a very important point, because Britain is clearly the Tarshish of Ezekiel 38, verse 13. And Britain with its young lions will oppose Gog's invasion of the land. So when we talk about the territories of these empires being brought together into one, it doesn't include Britain, because they were not there when the legs were formed of the Roman Empire. Now, I can't resist this, but I've got to say this again. America is not a young lion. Its political system is French-based. It preceded the French system, by the way, but it was French-based. There's a number of very important people went to France during the time of the French Revolution and afterwards, and they brought back the governmental system that finally overtook America. In the scripture, the lion is a symbol for government and rulership. You know that from the very first place where the lion is mentioned in the Bible, in Genesis 49, verses 9 to 10. It's a symbol for government. And America does not have a British form of government. But there are other powers who do. They're called the Young Lions, and this, of course, First World War poster, tells us what Ezekiel 38:13 means. When it talks about Tarshish, Britain, which can be proved both historically and from Scripture, Tarshish and its young lions, and they're trading, the merchants of Tarshish, they're trading powers together, which they haven't been, by the way, until very recently. And this First World War poster here mentions who they are: Australia, Canada, India, and New Zealand, all of whom have a British form of government, and three of them have the King, King Charles now, as their titular head of state. Okay? That's why they're called Young Lions. So I'd like you to have a look with me at Revelation 17. We just want to extend this idea of the ten horns. In Revelation chapter 17, we have the record in verse 1 of a whore. It says this: "And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters." Now, a woman, of course, in the scripture is a symbol for an ecclesiastical system. This woman is a harlot, a whore. So this is an apostate ecclesiastical system. She's described in this chapter as being the paramour of world rulers. She sits astride, if you read verse 3, she sits astride a scarlet-coloured beast which has 10 horns. And the imagery of that beast is taken from Revelation chapter 13, the beast of the sea, which is taken from Daniel chapter 7. So there's your connections, there's your links. And she sits upon many waters, and we know what those many waters are because we're told in verse 15. Verse 15 says, "The waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So here's an ecclesiastical system, apostate system, that sits astride a beast, a scarlet-coloured beast, which has its roots in Daniel, right? And it represents her power over many peoples, not just one nation, but over many nations. That's very important because this beast happens to have 10 horns. And those 10 horns, of course, were the powers that were established on the body of the Roman Empire by the barbarians in the 4th and 5th centuries. So look at the imagery here. Here's a picture of that area of the world. And we've got this power reigning over the kings of the earth. The red line represents what used to be the Roman Empire in its fullest extent. And this woman, this apostate system, sits there over that area of the earth's surface. Like, she has influence in that area. And we'll see how much that influence is in a moment. Just a point, though, about her being the paramour of the nations. Now, all these pictures here, of course, represent the activities of Pope John Paul II, who died in 2005. So it's a bit historical, but other popes, like the current pope, do the same thing. They're always, you know, carousing with the rulers of the world because they want to influence the governments of the world. They're doing their absolute best to influence them. Now, we've got in our community people who are all mixed up about Revelation chapter 17. And they say, well, the woman here is Israel. Apostate Israel. Really? How stupid is that? Because you see, this very chapter says if you've got wisdom, the mind that's got wisdom, you can tell from the chapter that it's not Israel. It's Rome that's being spoken. Now let's have a look at the evidence. In verse 9 you read, "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth." I don't know about seven. You never heard about seven hills in Israel? Rome was built on seven hills, wasn't it? Verse 10 says, "And there are seven kings." Rome had seven forms of government in its history. Verse 18 says, "And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." And I want you to notice that word reigneth. It's actually been translated correctly. It's in the present tense. Literally it says, which has kingship. That is, at the time when John recorded the Apocalypse, which was circa AD 96. Towards the end of the first century. Was Israel ruling over the kings of the world then? No, they were gone in AD 70, weren't they? So it's ridiculous ridiculous in the extreme to suggest that this has got anything to do with Israel. It's about the Catholic system that grew out of the Roman Empire. And the Catholic system is the only iron that's left in relation to the Roman Empire. It's got to be rebuilt, and it's in the process of being rebuilt. And, of course, the Romans themselves, this is a coin of Vespasian, who was the leader of the invasion of the land of Judea in AD 66 through 69 when he was made emperor, and Titus, his son, finished off the job. On the obverse side of that coin, you've got Rome as a woman, right, interestingly enough, sitting upon seven stones or seven hills, and the seven hills of Rome are detailed there. So here in Revelation 17, we've got some very important information for us in relation to our subject tonight. So what does prophecy require about these ten horns? Well, verses 12 and 13 tell you. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings. Now that means they're independent powers, but they're under control of someone else, which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, I'm not going to go into details, but most of us are familiar with the fact that when you read about 1 hour in Revelation, except for one place in chapter 9, verse 15, it's always a reference to a period of 30 years. Now, it can be easily proven by the mathematics of it and by history. In fact, there are two places in the Apocalypse where you can prove by history that it represents a period of 30 years. I'm not going to go into that now. Just accept my word for that for the time being. Most of you accept that anyway. But it says of these 10 kings, these have one mind. So they're controlled by one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Now, the beast, of course, is the one we've just been describing here, the scarlet-coloured beast with 10 horns. So what are we being told? There will be 10 independent nations with one political agenda shaped and guided by the papacy, then at that time with great power in southern Europe. So the consequences of that are this, that the European Union, otherwise known as the Eurozone, is doomed in its present form. British withdrawal, which happened, of course, finally in 2020, and bankruptcy among the southern nations, if not the northern, and some of them are in serious trouble, we'll see the northern nations leave for self-preservation. What prophecy requires is the reformation, just as Daniel 7 told us, the reformation of the old Roman Empire. You ought to see where that was. So what we're being told in this chapter, Revelation 17, is that this is about the restoration of papal power in Europe. The latter-day manifestation of what existed in history, the beast of the sea phase of Revelation 13, a revival of papal political power following the devastation of the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. Have a look at verse 16 of Revelation 17. Revelation 17, verse 16 says, "And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate, and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." Well, when did that happen? It happened in the French Revolution in 1789. For 30 years through to 1819, the European nations, particularly the French, chewed up Catholicism. They abolished Catholicism. They destroyed churches. So the whore was seriously impacted by the events of the French Revolution. Of course, it was part of the divine judgments against the Catholic system for what they had done to God's people. But it goes on to say this in verse 17. "For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled." In other words, it was all going to change. Now, it's 200 years ago, isn't it? The French Revolution, more than 200 years ago. A lot of things have changed since then, and the Catholic Church has ground its way back, climbed its way back. 1929, Il Duce in Italy gave the 100 acres of the Vatican back to the Church, and they became a state within a state. All of these things have happened. So they've regained a lot of their influence and power, but not what the Bible describes. That is yet to come. So what will finally restore papal power in Europe, do you think? There's a very simple answer to that. History proves it. Religion. On the back of a great depression. A return to religion on the back of the great depression that's coming. Now, how do we know this is true? Well, it's happened before. It happened in the 1990s, for example, when Russia fell apart and the USSR collapsed and Yeltsin came to power, remember? And there was starvation and there was all sorts of things going on in Russia. Guess what happened? The Russian Orthodox Church, which had almost been expunged by the communists over 70 years, they bulldozed 10,000 Russian Orthodox churches between 1917 and 1970. 10,000 of them. They pushed the church underground. They prevented the people from going to the church. But as soon as Russia was hit with all of those problems and the famine and the dislocation that occurred in the 1990s, guess what people did? They did the only thing that was available to them. They went back to the church. And you can't rule Russia today without the support of the Russian Orthodox Church, and Putin knows that. You can't rule Russia. And the time's coming when the Great Depression will do the same thing in Europe and particularly in France. And the Catholic Church will come back big time. And the Pope will have an influence that he doesn't have today. That's going to happen because of the time of trouble that is coming on the back of the Great Depression. And as we pointed out in the previous study, that's not too far down the track. Even the world is saying it's going to happen in the next 12 months. Right? So it's not too far down the track. And when that happens, we're going to get the revival of the old Roman Empire. That's where it is. You can see the map there. Yep, and that's the area where the barbarians came and established 10 independent nations, the 10 horns of the beasts, the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image. That's where they established it, to the south of the Rhine and the Danube. It doesn't include Germany. Germany was never fully part of the Roman Empire. For a time, the Romans were in it, but they were kicked out. They never ruled Germany properly. It was always below. To the south of the Rhine and the Danube. That was their territory. And that's where these 10 nations that we've just been talking about will be formed. And the coming Great Depression will dissolve the European Union, and these 10 nations will emerge, dependent upon the papacy and the territory of the old Roman Empire. And we will have the revival of the beast of the sea. It'll come back in a slightly different form, but the same principles involved of Revelation 13:1-10. We will have the fourth beast of Daniel 7 verse 7 revived, because it has to be destroyed, as we're told. And we'll have Babylon the Great of Revelation 17. That's what will happen. So Europe needs to be reshaped. And I want to show you that it's happening. But before I do that, I want to just address a problem that's arisen recently. We've got things circulating in our community where people are saying that Goma is not a reference to France. They want Goma over in Turkey, all right? Let's consider this. Let's have a look at what the scripture has to say and what our writings have to say about this. So we've got this problem, and what Brother Thomas wrote in Helpless Israel is being rejected. And I would recommend, if you want to jot these page numbers down, reread for yourselves in Helpless Israel, pages 426 through 428. Have another read of those pages. There's only three pages. There's a very important section. And in that section, Brother Thomas quotes numerous historians whose statements concerning the migration of the sons of Japheth west of the Atlantic coast have never been seriously questioned. But some are questioning it now. He cites Herodotus, B.C. 484 to 425, Diodorus Siculus, 1st century B.C., Josephus, the Jewish historian, A.D. 37 to 100, Strabo, B.C. 63 to A.D. 24, to demonstrate conclusively that Goma refers to France and Belgium, etc. This is what he wrote, for example, on page 428. Scythia above Gaul, from Diodorus, or Magog above Goma, or to the north of it, through which flowed the Elbe, Ems, and Weser, three rivers, was the country from whence proceeded principally that renowned people who in the early ages of Romanism formed an extensive confederacy with their kindred nations upon the Rhine, which had migrated successfully thither from the regions of the Danube, and who under the common denomination of Franks overran Gaul and subdued it, and finally establishing their power and population in the conquered country, permanently superseded the name of Gaul by that of France. And when you consider the evidence, I mean, it's palpably obvious that the Gomer of Ezekiel 38, verse 6, is a reference to France and probably to portion of Belgium, etc. He says this on page 428 about the location of the Franks. As for the seats of the Franks, says the Universal History, it appears from their constant excursions into Gaul that they dwelt on the banks of the Rhine in the neighbourhood of Metz. All historians speak of them as placed there till their settling in Gaul. Their country, according to the best modern geographers and historians, was bounded on the north by the ocean, on the west by the ocean, he means the Atlantic, and the Rhine, and on the south by the Main, and on the east by the Weser. So where are these places that are mentioned here? Well, there's the Rhine. You can see the arrow pointing to the Rhine. It runs down at the base of Germany, so to speak. You've got Metz, and you've got the Weser, a little bit to the north. And that's where the Gomerites initially settled when they came from the area of the Danube. They settled to the south of the Rhine, but they didn't stay there. They moved south. They pushed down into Gaul. That's why we are very confident that Gomer is a reference to France. And this is France in the Bible, Ezekiel 38, verse 6. Gomer and all his bands, the house of Pergama of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee, it says. And this is what Brother Thomas says. He wrote this in 1849. In this general description may easily be discerned that extended portion of the west of Europe, comprehending ancient Gaul, Belgium, and the countries bordering upon them, which constituted in our day the Napoleon Empire. Gomer then points immediately to France. It is a curious coincidence that Louis Philippe paid his visit to England in a boat called the Gomer. When this vessel was thus named, did they adopt it allusively to their country being originally peopled by the descendants of Gomer? Well, probably. He asked the question, it's probably yes. See, there's a lot of evidence, a heap of evidence, that Gomer is a reference to France. So why is that important? Well, it's important because of what's going on in France, the metamorphosis of French politics. There was an election in 2016, you might recall. Marine Le Pen, the right-wing daughter of one of the most extreme fanatics that France has ever produced, Monsieur Le Pen, he's now dead, of course. His daughter took over his party. She lost the election, but she won the war of ideology. Macron became president with a large majority, didn't even have a party to start with, by the way, in the French parliament, and the socialists who had ruled France for a long time were pushed to the side. The right were also sidelined. However, during the campaign, Macron was forced to adopt some of Le Pen's hardline approaches. So who is this woman? Well, here's some history about her. Way back, November the 17th, 2016, Alina Polakova of the Atlantic Council wrote this about Marine Le Pen. France has a major far-right Eurosceptic and openly pro-Russian party that receives funding from the Kremlin. That cost her votes. One of the reasons why she lost the election, it cost her votes. So she's modified her policies in relation to that. Still got the same policy, but she's modified the way she speaks about them. It goes on to say in the Daily Express of the 4th of October of 2016, as leader of the National Front, she advocates leaving the Eurozone, withdrawal from NATO, abolition of the IMF, that's the International Monetary Fund, limits on immigration, it's a big problem in Europe, and forging what she calls a privileged partnership with Russia. Now, just let that sink in. A privileged partnership, not a partnership, but a privileged partnership with Russia. That's her policy. She described Russian President Vladimir Putin as the defender of the Christian heritage of European civilization. Why would she say that? Because she's a Catholic. That's why. And she wants to see Catholicism reinstalled as a power in France. She's probably going to win the next election because there will be a depression happening at the time. And when you get depressions, people go to the right wing. All right, that's what they do. They go to the right wing in politics. Watch out. Watch out. The European Union is doomed. So what about Marine Le Pen? Well, she's softened her approach for the time being, but it won't be long, and she won't need to. She can come out in the open again. This is what the Carnegie Europe article said on the 18th of October 2022. Since the beginning of the Eurozone crisis in 2009, the European Union has experienced a series of challenges, including a massive influx of refugees. I can't handle it. Brexit, the coronavirus pandemic, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It is safe to predict that this era of crises will continue for a number of years. Geopolitical rivalries and turmoil in neighbouring regions, deep economic and social inequalities, and accelerating global warming make for a tougher environment than the Union has ever faced. Yeah, they're in trouble. And so is Germany. Now, here's a bit more history for you. See the date of the article? February 2016. Nothing's new, is it? Germany's problems began a long time ago, and they're maturing rapidly. This is what this report said. A report to be put before Schäuble, who was the finance minister at the time, next week, states that unless Germany starts making huge cuts to its state budget now, which, by the way, they haven't, it will be unable to sustain the debt burden caused by an aging population, who are now 7 years older, and a low birth rate. Unless the finance minister takes drastic action, the German debt-to-GDP ratio will reach 220% by 2060. That's the year, by the way, that the papacy and the beast that supports it go down the gurgler. And that's worse than what Greece was. Massively above the 60% limit set out under the Maastricht Agreement of 1992. Maastricht Agreement was the basis of the European Union as we know it today. Germany, being a central pillar of the Eurozone, is under huge pressure to keep within the fiscal rules of the single currency agreement, which they haven't. And that's 7 years ago. Okay, so they've been in trouble for a long time. So they brought home their gold in 2016 and 17. After World War II, the Allies held Germany's gold reserves overseas to secure peace. You've got your gold. Germany has recalled $32 billion worth of gold reserves, 674 tons of it, from France and the US. This was the article reported in 2017 by Reuters. Preparing for the disaster, if Germany has gone through the political and logistical effort to successfully demand that its gold be returned to German soil, this could be an indication that Germans are preparing for a crisis. Germany could be preparing for a specific crisis. Back in February, when the German government first announced that the gold transfers would be completed ahead of schedule, Reuters wrote, some even argue the world's second biggest bullion reserve may be needed to back a new Deutschmark should the Eurozone break up. Yeah, you can see where that's at. That's 2017, 6 years ago. So what about today in Germany? What about 2023? Reuters on the 6th of October this year. The German economy suffered a recession in the last quarter of 2022 and the first quarter of 2023. That's a recession. Two technical recessions defined as two consecutive GDP contractions. From the same article, Germany's government expects the economy to shrink by 0.4% this year due to high inflation, high energy prices, and weak international trade. They don't have access to cheap Russian oil and gas anymore. From the same article, five economic institutes are predicting Germany's economy will shrink by 0.6% this year as the recovery of industry and private consumption has been slower than previously expected. They also say inflation is expected to come in at 6.1% this year. It's even worse than ours. And this is what the European Commission said on the 11th of September this year. Now, this is the crowd that runs the European Union. Don't tell you things that they want you to know. But this is what they're prepared to admit to. Think of what they really could tell you if they were telling the truth. The German economy stagnated in the second quarter of 2023 following a decrease in real GDP, gross domestic product, of 0.1% in the first quarter. For both quarters, growth was significantly weaker than previously expected. Real wage losses continued to weigh on private consumption during the first half of 2023. Additionally, weak dynamics in external demand led to subdued exports. You're not selling as many Mercedes-Benzes anymore, are they? Reflecting the progressive phasing out of COVID-19 related spending. By contrast, a rebound in investment from a weak last quarter of 2022 supported growth. Yeah, you know, they try and sort of build it up a little bit. So what is politically? This is what's happening. The growth of the far right. Just like in France. The far right alternative for Germany party, they're called the AfD, is set to make the controlled dissolution of the European Union one of its key targets for the upcoming European elections, with its leader, Tino Chrupalla, calling Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, one of his main allies. We've got some others too, you know. You know who that party has allies with, that they're allied with? The Austrian right-wing party. The fellow who in Holland is trying to form a right-wing government. Yeah, they're allied with him too. But it's interesting that they should have allies in Hungary and Austria. You know why? Because the last vestiges of the Holy Roman Empire was the Austro-Hungarian Empire that disappeared in the First World War. Right? That was the last vestiges of the Holy Roman Empire. And the whole point of the formation of the European Union was to rebuild the Holy Roman Empire, called the Fourth Reich, by the way. That was the whole point of the exercise. And now we've got this German party, we've got a Hungarian right-wing party, we've got an Austrian right-wing party, and they're in hock, they're in bed together. And when the depression comes, you can see what's going to happen. This is what they said. This is what this fellow, the leader of that party, said. We're demanding a reset for Europe so that we can use the potential of nation states and rebuild the bridge to the east. He doesn't say Russia, does he? But he means Russia. He's talking about rebuilding Germany's relationship with Russia. So if you're wondering how it is that Germany and France and other European nations, the European Union, are supplying money and weapons to Ukraine and fighting against Russia, how that's all going to change, it's going to change. It's going to change because of the Great Depression. It's already unraveling, by the way. So will the European Union currency collapse? More articles from Reuters. Analysts have described 2022 as the worst year in the euro's history. However, the euro's relevance has been in decline for the last two decades. Its share of global official holdings of foreign exchange reserves was 20.6% at the end of 2021, down from around 25% in 2003. The euro has lost 16% of its value against the dollar, that is the US dollar, over the past year, and is trading at the lowest since December 2002. The single currency is currently 20% lower than its average since 1999. Yep, just another huge indicator that the European Union and its currency are doomed. They're in deep trouble, and the coming depression will complete its dissolution, making way for the fulfillment of Bible prophecy and the reformation of the old Roman Empire in southern Europe. Now, as we wind up this study, brothers and sisters and young people, let's have a little bit of a look at what prophecy requires. This is the history of papal power. To the left-hand side of this chart, you have AD 529 to 533. That was the time. That was the period of the Justinian Decretals, Justinian Decrees, they call them, granting the Bishop of Rome political power and influence in the West. This is the beginning of the beast of the sea. But it was to end in 1260 years. That's what prophecy required. And it did. It ended with the French Revolution, 1789 to 1793. It was exactly 1260 years. But what about the beast of the earth? See in the middle there, the beast of the earth? Well, that was established, that's the Holy Roman Empire. That was established in 800 AD on Christmas Day, 25th of December, 800 AD, when Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Daniel 7:25 tells us it's going to last for 1260 years. Well, add on 1260 to 800. Where do you come to? 2060. Where's the mathematicians in the room? How many years is that away? 36. Yeah. And there's got to be a lot of things happen, haven't there, in that 36 years. A lot of things. Tells you how close we are, brothers and sisters. So let's conclude with these little illustrations of what we've been talking about tonight. This is the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ for 40 years after Armageddon. And Revelation 17, verses 1 to 3, is all about that. It's about this system, Babylon the Great, Catholicism ruling in Europe, that will oppose Christ, seek to destroy him and destroy his people, the children of Israel, returning under Elijah in the second Exodus. And there will be, when it says there on the left hand of that chart, the return of Christ, that doesn't mean to take you and me to the judgment seat. That means his appearance with us at the time of Armageddon, all right? His appearance to the nations of the earth. He's come 10 years prior to that. And you've got 40 years of divine judgment leading to the subjugation of all nations. So Armageddon is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven of Matthew 24, verse 30. It leads to the decimation of Catholicism. But that doesn't stop them. Psalm 2 describes them as assembling together tumultuously, saying, we will cast the bands away. They don't want Christ to rule over them. And while the saints are going out with the message of submission, submit, you fools, they're rebuilding their system in what's left of Rome, because it will suffer dreadfully with the great earthquake. But they rebuild what they've got there. And 10 years after Armageddon, as Revelation 14 verse 8 tells us, it goes down the gurgler for good. But it doesn't stop them. They go to Central Europe, what's left of them. They elect a new pope, and we get the restoration of the beast of the earth in Central Europe. At the very time that Elijah's got returning Jews in Central Europe. And they are the vehicle, the weapon that is used against Babylon the Great until 2060, when that system's leaders are destroyed. The beast and the false prophet are destroyed. Not the Catholics. There's still Catholics left. It's going to take another 10 years to clean them up. So Revelation chapter 19, verse 20 is about the destruction of the beast and the papacy. But Revelation chapter 19, verse 21 is about the cleaning up of the remaining Catholics who supported that system. They'll have no leadership anymore. And that'll be the job given to the saints. But Christ finally has his universal rule over the nations. So what we have here is a repetition of history. History repeated like it is so often. We've got the revival of the beast of the sea, papacy with power in Europe, opposing Christ. Then, of course, it morphs into the revival of the beast of the earth, centered in Germany and Central Europe. That's where Charlemagne was. Until finally that system and the papacy go down the gurgler, 2060. That's the story, brothers and sisters. Now, one more point. If you're still in Revelation 17, I want you to have a look at verse 12 again. Revelation 17, verse 12. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, if the beast is destroyed 30 years after Armageddon, it means that the 30 years that they have power with the beast starts at the time of Armageddon. That's when that 30 years begins. They have power with the beast. Beast is destroyed 30 years later. But there's another period, come back to chapter 14, is another period of 30 years. Chapter 14, Revelation, have a look with me at verses 6 and 7. This is the message that goes out by the saints from Christ post-Armageddon. Goes on for 10 years. I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven. Goes to governments and people. That's why it's in the midst of heaven. It's to the rulers and it's to the people below. Having the everlasting gospel, not talking about the gospel of the kingdom of God, by the way, it's a demand, some too, it's a demand for submission. And to them that dwell on the earth, that's the Roman earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come. And worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Now it's the same period, length-wise. It's 30 years. It's an hour. But it doesn't start with Armageddon. It starts 10 years after Armageddon. So this period is this one here. From the time when Rome is destroyed, 10 years after Armageddon, to the time when all Catholics have been eradicated from the earth and the fourth beast has been utterly destroyed, as Daniel 7, verses 11 and 12 require. There's two separate 30 years. When they're concurrent, they cross over each other. Two separate periods of 30 years. Got a picture? It's a pretty bright picture, brothers and sisters, because it's telling us something. We're not very far away from the culmination of these things. And we'll probably witness what I've been talking about tonight from another place. Another place. It's called Sinai. And there's a mountain. The mountain of judgment. That's where we're going. So let's look very carefully at our lives, brothers and sisters. Let's get ourselves ready for the inevitable. It's coming, and it's coming pretty quickly. The world knows it's coming. You and I must know it's coming. And let's make sure we're ready.